Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Dom Harvey podcast, brought to you by, well, potentially you. More on that in just a second. Coming up, Freddie Bennett.
I felt the barrel pressing into my temple, and then they pulled the trigger. I don't know if there was a bullet in the gun. I don't know if it jammed. I don't know what happened. All I know is I heard the click, and it wasn't until afterwards I thought, shit, they've just pulled the trigger on the gun.
Yeah, Freddie Bennett. Not a big name, not a household name, possibly not even a name you've heard of, but a very cool story of transformation. Freddie is an Englishman who now calls New Zealand home. He shares his remarkable pivot from life in one fast lane to life in another fast lane. In his old life, he was chasing cheap dopamine by shoveling mountains of cocaine up his nose. Now he's leaning into the search for a quality dopamine hit by pushing his body to the limit physically and doing cool shit. And in the process, becoming a better person and making himself, his family and his community proud, which I think is really cool. At the time of recording this, Freddie was preparing to leave New Zealand to take part in a 5-day, 250-kilometre running event in the Arctic. This involves carrying all the food, supplies and equipment he needs to survive, temperatures of as low as negative 50 degrees, and running over frozen lakes and mountains. Vastly different to the 5-day cocaine blizzards Freddie used to experience in his corporate life in the UK before moving to NZ. We talk about a lot of stuff here, including the moment in New York where a drug dealer held a gun to Freddie's head, the sudden death of his dad and the impact that that had on him, his decision to move to New Zealand with his family, and much, much more. Just before we get into it, I need to tell you this episode is brought to you by, well, nobody. I'm now releasing 2 episodes per week. It's a massive commitment and a massive step up, and I'm looking to form some new partnerships with cool brands. If you think your business could benefit from sponsoring one of New Zealand's fastest growing podcasts, please get in touch. DomHarveyNZ@gmail.com. That's DomHarveyNZ@gmail.com. Let's talk. You're listening to this right now, and it could be promoting your business. So get in touch. Love to hear from you. Okay, let's get into it. Freddie Bennett on the Dom Harvey podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I am very excited about this one.
Yeah, mate, I'm so pleased that you made the time to come here today. I was thinking about how we structure this, and I think it might be like a podcast of 2 halves. So first half, we'll get to know a bit about you, Freddie Bennett, and your backstory and your story. And then second half, just some maybe like sort of tips, tricks, pointers, hacks that anyone can use for mindset and resilience and the good stuff like that.
All the good stuff. No worries.
Yeah, because you, according to your website, you help people get unstuck, unfucked and unleashed.
Yep.
Which I love. and you've done the hard work and you've found the stuff out the hard way. So just a quick introduction. Who is Freddie Bennett?
So Freddie Bennett is a guy, to quote the opposite of my website, used to be stuck, fucked, unleashed. I would talk about the new me and the old me, and the old me lived a very different life. You probably guessed by now, I'm from the UK originally, moved out here to New Zealand 3 years ago, and the old me had a very different life. I was working in the corporate world in London. At the age of 35, I was a director at a big finance firm. I had all the things I was supposed to have. I had the Rolex on the wrist, the Porsche on the driveway. I had the granite in the kitchen. I had the ski holidays, the young family. But on the inside, life was falling apart. I was stressed. I wasn't sleeping. I was massively unfit. I was overweight, heavy drinking every night. All the other paraphernalia that we say that goes with that heavy drinking lifestyle.
Oh, the coke.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Well, it's a rite of passage in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You can't, like, put it on your cornflakes so much in the UK. And I was very much living this lifestyle. partly through my own design, partly because I wasn't very happy with my life. I wasn't really happy with who I was. And now I look back, I know I was trying to destroy that version of me. But that was me and that was my life. And that's why I felt stuck. I felt stuck because I thought, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is as good as it gets. As someone living in the UK, probably as a man as well, thinking, look, I was fitter when I was younger, but now I'm a grown up. I've got to do the job thing and do the work thing and the beer belly and the poor sleeping. And I was just living this life of quiet desperation. And it was only when I thought, what could I really be capable of achieving? What do I actually want to create with my life? That I embarked on this journey as such. But as I say, 5 years ago, I wasn't the person you see today. I was that old version of me that was living this life that he didn't really want to live.
What do you weigh now? Because you're in good shape. And what did you weigh when you were at your peak weight?
Well, that's very cuddy to say. So I was I'm a bit heavier than I should be now. So I'm about 79 kilos now. At my peak, I was about 95.
Right.
So yeah, it was a bit different.
From what I've read about you and the research I've done, would you say you were an alcoholic? Or just a dude with a drinking problem?
It's a grey area. It's a funny one. I've asked myself this question so many times. I definitely had a drink problem, without a doubt. I think that's why so many, what they call middle lane drinkers, middle class drinkers, however you want to label yourself, I would tell myself, look, you know, I don't have to drink a bottle of vodka to go to work every morning, even though I did sometimes have a drink before I went to work every morning. I told myself, you know, I've got a job, I've got a family, I'm not waking up on a park bench. I'm just a guy who likes that all or nothing lifestyle. That's what we all say. I'm all or nothing. I don't have an off switch. I'm the life and soul of the party.
All gas, no brakes.
Yeah, exactly. But the warning signs were there. Yeah. You know, I would be more and more late for work. I'd be getting into more trouble at work. Then you think, well, there was that time when I got chased out of a country because I was blind drunk in the Middle East where alcohol was illegal. There was a time I got thrown off a plane. There was the time when I was in New York City and I had drug dealers holding a gun to my head and one of them actually pulled the trigger. And there was these moments when you wake up. And I think maybe we've all had these moments, maybe not to such an extreme level. You wake up and you think, right, I'm going to change. Enough is enough. This is it. I'm going to change. And then I would say to myself, okay, this is it. New me. It's all going to change right after the next project, right after the next birthday, right after the next Christmas, after the next pay rise, after the next child. There would always be something that would cause me to kick my hopes and dreams down the road and kick the real me in the guts. So was I an alcoholic? Probably. Did I have a drink problem? Definitely. But it's funny. I was very much one of life's victims. And I always say, maybe we'll come on to this. I believe our lives are a story. And you can be the hero in your story or the villain in your story. But both the hero and the villain start out as the victim. And that was me. I was a victim. So I was saying, it's my boss's fault. It's my client's fault. It's the economy's fault. It's my wife's fault. It's my kid's fault. It's the traffic's fault. Definitely not me. Definitely not the drinking. I was willing to point the finger everywhere but at myself. It was only when I started to literally look in the mirror and say, this is not the way life's supposed to go. Mm. This is not who I'm supposed to be, that I actually started to make some changes.
Yeah, I love that. There's a book I've been reading over summer written by some ex-Navy SEALs called Extreme Ownership. And it's basically...
Jocko Willing, is it? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's basically all about that. It's just... Yeah, extreme ownership. It's just owning absolutely fucking everything, owning all your shit. I think a lot of people kind of get a kick out of being a victim in a way. Mm. You know, there's a lot in having a victim mentality because you get people saying, oh, poor you. And that can be an adrenaline rush for people, but it's not going to get you very far in life, is it?
I know. I used to love being, I loved being a victim. Being a victim is great fun because you get to complain. And let's face it, complaining, if you've got a choice, do I complain about my problems? Well, that's fun. Do I fix my problems? Well, that means doing things like going running. That means having to have honest conversations. That means having a harsh look in the mirror. That doesn't sound very fun. Complaining is a lot more fun. I always used to say every problem that you've had for longer than a few months is because you have become attached to that problem. It's because you have decided to keep that problem. So if you've got a money problem, it's because really you've decided to keep that problem. Got a fitness problem, it's because you decided to keep that problem. Problem relationship, problem client, problem with a family member. Any problem that we have for longer than a few months is because we decided to keep that problem. And for me, that was a truth that I did not want to face up to. I didn't want to accept that really I was the root cause of my problems. As you said, I loved being a victim. Victims, we always say as well that we believe that we're special and that we're unique. So we say, I've tried everything. I've tried every diet. I'm just, you know, being overweight runs in my family.
It's my metabolism.
Yeah, it's my metabolism. I've got a sweet tooth. It's like, what's a sweet tooth? We always say, look, I've tried every gym. I've tried every exercise routine. I've tried every way to quit drinking. I've tried everything, but I'm special. Really, we believe that we're different, but we're not. What is the truth is that nothing changes until we decide to change. It has to start with ourselves.
Yeah. Hey, you brought it up before, so I want to pick away at this for a little bit. The New York incident.
Yes.
What the fuck?
Yeah, that was a scary one. So I was in New York.
Holiday or what?
It was a stag do bachelor party. Right. So not exactly like a wholesome spa retreat, that's right. For sure.
So you're trying to get some coke?
Yeah, basically.
And so, you didn't know any dealers, so you just went in a street or something.
So this was the way it went down. So it's a very great summary of my lifestyle time. I was in the UK. We went to New York for a weekend. Imagine like a low budget Wolf of Wall Street. That was kind of like the lifestyle that I lived, thinking that we were these high rollers, but with a champagne roller with a beer budget. Okay. And it was the last day of the bachelor party. So I'd been partying for 3 days straight. I was all over the place. We'd been in a nightclub till 3 o'clock in the morning. I kind of forgot where I was. I thought I was in England, where all the drug dealers are friendly in England. And it's like, hello, sir. Would you like some drugs? Oh, thank you very much. That would be lovely. What do you have? Forgetting I was in New York City, where you have a different standard of drug dealer as such. So we were walking down the street and... I haven't thought about this incident for a long time, but some guys come up, do you want any drugs? And I was like, well, yes, I would, actually.
Thank you, thank you.
Funnily enough, at 3 a.m, this guy whose eyes were as wide as saucers. So yes, I would. And long story short, I think during the procurement process, should we say, I kind of probably had a bit of a dose of reality that I need to be on a plane home in 5 hours' time. Maybe this isn't the best idea. So I started to kind of back out of the transaction. I had a friend there as well.
What was it? Was it like an instinct thing that just sort of something just not sit right with you, with the people?
It was weird. Like, it was almost this moment of clarity where I was like, This isn't going to go very well. I think it's probably a moment of clarity, as in maybe you've been partying too hard for the weekend and it's time to literally and metaphorically go home. I think there were starting to moments of clarity into my life, thinking, I mean, let's face it, I wasn't a 22-year-old. I was 35. I had the family waiting for me at home. I wasn't some college kid. I had responsibilities.
You're grown ass man.
Yeah, and as it, all things in life, what goes up does come down. I was probably on a very massive come down. So I was like, you know what? Thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to go on my way. The said drug dealer, he kind of said, well, no, basically. And then, to cut a long story short, I thought that I was in the UK, kind of having a bit of banter, a bit of backwards and forwards, kind of like just taking the piss, basically. And then when the guy punched me in the face, it became very serious. And I used to have this very big, blingy Rolex at the time. And he was like, they tried to grab the watch off my wrist. And I was like, no, don't take my watch.
It's my identity.
Yeah, it's my identity. That's who I am. I'm the Rolex wearing guy. This is me. And then so he hit me again. And then they marched me to an ATM, to a cash point. And then he said, you're going to take out all your money right now. And if you try and run, we're going to fucking kill you. And I was like, right, this is serious. And then, I tried to, again, talk my way out of it. Not the best idea. I probably wasn't at my most coherent at that stage. And then that's when the gun came out. And they pushed me against the wall, against the ATM, forced me down onto my knees, shoved the gun. I felt the barrel pressing into my temple. And then they pulled the trigger. And it was that kind of thing where I didn't realise it had happened until it happened. I don't know if there was a bullet in the gun. I don't know if it jammed. I don't know what happened. All I know is I heard the click. And then you kind of, I was in this weird kind of fight or flight instinct. And it wasn't until afterwards I thought, shit, they've just pulled a trigger on the gun. And then here's the part that's half funny and half stupid. So they picked me up again. And then they said, right, your money's coming out now. And I got the card out, put it to the machine. And then in the bravest and the most stupid thing I've done in my life, I actually did the whole, what's that over there? And they looked and I ran. And you talk about a running podcast. I have never run so fast. So after them saying, if you run, we will kill you, I ran. And my hotel was only probably a couple of blocks away. I ran across roads. I didn't even look for traffic. I just sprinted. I literally ran.
Running for your life.
For literally. My life, yeah. And I threw myself through the hotel doors. And I remember there's no alpha male here. There's no machismo. I ran through the hotel door going like, help me, help me, help me. Ah, they're trying to get me. And then they called the police. The NYPD turned up. And again, when you've been partying all sorts of ways for 3 days, having a conversation with two police officers wasn't the best thing to have. And then, bless the NYPD turned up, and in a very New York way, I'm sorry for the accent. They were like, sir, have you been shot? And I was like, no. And they were like, okay, sir, have you been stabbed? I was like, no. And they were like, so what? And then, well, they were really mean, and they pulled a gun, and they were like, well, they were like, welcome to New York. Off you go to bed. And then I obviously didn't go to bed, and then got up the next, a few hours later, not really sleeping, got on a plane home. And the funny part at the end of the story is I got home, obviously, feeling very hungover, very tired, very sorry for myself, having that whole kind of, maybe I should really have a look in the mirror and change my life, unpacking my suitcase, unpacking my shirts and everything. And I pulled out a bag of cocaine. And I was like, now I know why he was so angry at me, because I stole his drugs after all. And I was like, oh, actually, I really understand where he was at. That's why he was so annoyed with me. I didn't realise he'd given me the drug. And I was like, I felt guilty. I was like, I bet he's going to get into trouble with his boss because I took his drugs. I didn't pay him. And yeah, that was just one of the stories. But the funny thing is, and I say I laugh about it, but it was deadly serious. That's when I remember I sat there amongst all my clothes on the floor thinking, well, Freddie, you're a family man, you're 30 now, you've got this career. Maybe here's a warning sign that you should maybe change your life. But I didn't. Mm. And that wasn't even the rock bottom. That was a warning sign. And I said to myself, as we all do after a heavy weekend, no more, I'm not going to do this. But within a week's time, I was back in the bars. I made myself all the promises that we tend to make ourselves around, I won't drink spirits. I'll just have a couple. I'll only drink at weekends. I'll start running. And I would start running for a while, funnily enough, because then I would have earned a beer at the end of it. So I literally started running to justify my drinking. Mm. All these signs were there until, obviously, I finally hit that rock bottom.
It's hard, isn't it? It's for anyone that has had that moment where you sort of reassess your relationship with alcohol, there's always a lot of false starts, but you only need to get it right once.
One of my favourite phrases, definitely.
Yeah, but it's hard, isn't it? Because every time you say you're going to do something and then don't, your self-esteem drops a little bit. You feel like you've let yourself down. You feel like a loser, a failure.
Definitely.
But I think trying and failing is better than not trying at all.
Well, this is what I say. I'm a proud failure. I have tried and failed 1,000 times.
Yeah.
I failed to change my drinking habits. I failed to start my running habits. I failed in relationships. I failed in diets. I failed thousands and thousands of times. But as you say, what I firmly believe is you only need to get it right once. Then you win. Then life changes forever.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So you get back from New York. By the way, I'm alarmed you didn't stop then. Yeah. But do you tell your wife straight away? Do you walk in the door and like burst into tears? Do you feel guilt or shame? What are you feeling at that point?
I felt guilt. I felt shame. Was I totally honest? No. The reason being, I didn't really want to ask for help because we always talk about a journey. I'd been on a mental health journey in the past. And the funny thing is, and I always talk about the real version of the story and the Hollywood version of the story. We all know the Hollywood version. Someone, and they say in many cases men, but obviously for both sexes, but I know for men, they always say, you know, suicide is the biggest killer for men under 45. We are our own worst enemy, literally and metaphorically. So I struggled with my mental health and I did all the things I was supposed to do. I put my hand up. I asked for help. I quit drinking. I got the therapy. I read the books by Robbins. I had the podcasts by Goggins. I tried to feel the fear and do it anyway. I even practiced the subtle art of not giving a fuck, but it didn't work. And that's the hard thing. In my head, I was thinking, I've done all the right things. I've done the man thing. I've done the difficult thing. I've asked for help, but I still didn't feel fixed as such. You know, again, maybe it's a male thing, but I think in my brain, like a car. The car's not working. You take it into the auto shop, into the garage. They have a little tinker around, and then it's working again. I thought, hang on, it should be the same with my brain. I've cried the tears, lay on the couch, got the therapy. Why aren't I fixed now? And that's why I came home from New York, and it wasn't just to my wife, it was to my friends, my family, to everyone. I was like, yeah, you know, heavy weekend, good fun. And then I put the mask on, and I believe that we all wear the mask.
100%.
We believe that we should be this person who people expect us to be. And this is one of the big discoveries for me. It was, I thought to be a quote-unquote success, to be confident, to be resilient, I couldn't have any weaknesses. I had to have this mask on all the time that, I have everything under control. I'm fit, I'm healthy, I'm successful, I'm sociable, I'm the life and soul of the party, all these things. But it really meant that I was like a photocopy of a photocopy of someone who I didn't really want to be. And because I had this pressure to conform, to maintain this mask, this facade, I felt I couldn't tell anyone what was really going on. Because really, I didn't have that confidence. And you talked about keeping promises we make to ourselves. It's funny, the word confidence comes from, I think, French, that derived from Latin. And it's con fidere. Con means intense, fidere means trust. So the meaning of the word means intense trust. So we do not have confidence because we do not trust ourselves. We do not trust ourselves because we keep breaking the promises that we make to ourselves. So every time we say, I'm going to quit drinking, and we don't, we break a promise. Every time we say, I'm going to go for a run tomorrow morning, the alarm goes off at 5 a.m. We think, oh, no way. We break a promise we make to ourselves. So then we say, well, why aren't I confident? That's why. When we start keeping the promises we make, that's when our confidence grows. But at that stage, I was breaking promises to everyone, especially myself. And that's why I had no confidence.
You were still quite high functioning though, eh? Like you were, you were getting shit done.
I was getting shit done. Even worse, I thought I was doing shit better. I thought the more I screwed up my life, the better I was performing. And partly this was, again, a lie that I told myself, because I said to work a high power job, it's very stressful. I need alcohol.
Need to let off some steam.
Yeah, I need alcohol to let off some steam, to work, to entertain clients, to perform at my best. People won't want me around in the bar. I loved it. Alcohol is derived of this demonic poison. I would be lying if I said I didn't love it. I walk into a bar, have everyone go, yay, Freddie's here. I really got a high off that. It made me feel good. It made me feel wanted. I believe we all want to live a life of meaning. We all want to feel like we belong. We all want to feel like we can have the power to make things happen. And alcohol gave me that. So yeah, that's what I told myself. I thought, maybe I should quit my drinking habits. I thought, but you've got a Porsche on the driveway. Life can't be that bad. I was like, maybe I should do some exercise. But you were promoted last year. You've got a marriage of some description. You have children who don't always hate you. And it's always funny. we always have a way of convincing ourselves. Yeah. And I believe that's because our brains, ironically and quite paradoxically, want to keep us safe. I believe as humans, from evolution, we're designed to sit around and seek pleasure and sitting around drinking. So my brain again was saying to me, you have a choice. You can choose discomfort, which is doing something difficult, hard, like quitting drinking, or you can choose comfort. Tell yourself a story. Tell yourself you're going to quit next year. Tell yourself you're just unwinding, that people love this version of you, that you can't let people down by quitting drinking. You know, what would they say at the wedding that you're going to next month? What would they say at your birthday? And that, to be fair, that's what people did say to me. They said, oh, this is how bullshit it was. I had a nickname for myself, Funtime Freddy. And they'd be like, oh, where's Funtime Freddy? Where's Funtime gone? But it's okay. Here he is. Ta-da. But it's very much like that life of a clown where in the spotlight, I enjoyed being this drunken entertainer. But when I was off the stage, that's when the darkness and the sadness came in.
Do you miss it at all? What do you miss about it?
I miss a lot about it.
Something about the camaraderie. I don't like doing shots of tequila or Fireball or Jägermeister, but I do love the camaraderie of, you know, clinking the glasses. Definitely. And then pulling faces afterwards. And
I miss the camaraderie. I miss the build-up. Kind of like, and we had this a lot over Christmas, you know, the trip to the bottle shop, the what's it going to be? What wine am I going to get? Are we going to get gin or vodka? Maybe let's get both. And, you know, all that, almost that routine.
Like the anticipation.
Yeah, the anticipation of it. That's what I miss. I probably miss everything that happens before 9 p.m. That's when times are fun, when it's, you know, when you're having the laughs, when you're making the memories. Everything after 9 p.m. I don't miss. But all that, yeah, you know, that buzz that you get when all your worries have slowly drifted away, that is what I still miss. But then I think about everything that comes after 9 p.m. and the days after. And that's what I really found when I failed to quit so many times, because I thought it was a case of willpower. I thought it was a case of going cold turkey, you know, white knuckle it and try and beat the demon, as they say, beat the demon. It doesn't work like that. For anything that you're trying to quit, it isn't about leaving something. It's about going towards something. So I wasn't quitting alcohol. I was choosing better sleep, better running, better relationships, loving myself, more confidence. I had to be going towards something. And that's why I think I failed so many times. I had no meaning to move towards. I had no goal. I had no reason as such. And it's strange to say, my wife, my kids, my family, my job, it wasn't a strong enough reason. And that's why I see so many people that try and change their life. They're trying to do it for someone else. They're trying to do it to impress someone. Many of the changes we make in our lives, it is down to guilt or obligation. We're doing it because we feel guilty or because we feel obliged to please someone else. It isn't until you say, no, I'm going to do this for me, for my goals, for my life, even though a lot of people are going to call me selfish, that's when you start to actually get on the right path and start to make things happen.
Yeah, I watched a podcast with them. Do you know Steve-O from Jackass?
Yes, yeah. I do. Yeah, I used to love Jackass.
And he battled with drug and alcohol issues for years. And he had a really good point. He said alcoholism and addiction is the only disease that when you're cured from it, your life gets better. Because any other disease like cancer, you want to get back to your old self again.
Yeah.
That's the benchmark. But this is the one thing where your life is going to be better.
It's a funny one. And And I do think Steve-O is an interesting concept. Here's a theory that I've been toying with and playing with for a long time, is that you cannot deny your true nature. And I know so many people who have gone on a sobriety journey, also with things like with food and exercise as well. I believe you cannot deny your true nature. So I know who I am. I am quite a dopamine addict. I am quite all or nothing. I do like doing bold, brave, stupid things. In the past, when I call this the New Year's Day syndrome, in the past, I would wake up and I'd say, right, I'm going to have the life of a monk. I'm going to be going to bed at 8 o'clock every night. I'm going to never let a swear word escape my... I was trying to be someone who I wasn't. And I think so many people actually try, and when they change their habits, whether it's starting a habit or stopping a habit, they try and change who they are. Mm. But I think that's like trying to build a house on top of an oak tree.
Yeah, setting yourself up for failure,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly. I think you cannot deny your true nature. And it's about trying to direct that true nature into more of a positive path. But I think if you are a certain type of person, if you have a certain type of personality, if you try and totally kill that old version of you, it's going to come out in certain ways. It's like the artist who says, I'm not going to be an artist. I'm going to go and get a proper corporate job. Eventually, they will self-sabotage it because deep down, all they want to do is be an artist. Mm. So I believe if we put ourselves in life situations, if we try and hide who we truly are, then we'll find a way to self-sabotage it, let the real version of us through. And that's why so many people fall off the wagon, because they are trying to change a habit, but they're also trying to kill that version of themselves, who they really want to be.
Mm. So what was the last straw? Was it eventful, or was it...
It's a really funny one. In a way, it's quite poetic, because you had the drug dealer and the gun thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like...
For most people, by the way, most sensible people, that would be it.
Yeah, that would be it. Yeah, you call it a warning sign, definitely. But it was funny that the real rock bottom was a lot less Hollywood, a lot less glamorous. It was the 8th, come to the anniversary of it. It was the 8th of March. It would have been 2019, I believe. And I came to, it was a Thursday, I went Brickley. I came to, I was going to say woke up, but regained consciousness is the right way of saying it. In a strange grey hotel room, in the middle of a grey hotel, next to a grey highway, on a grey, rainy UK day. I woke up, didn't know where I was. I kind of staggered my way to the bathroom, kicking away discarded miniature bottles of Jack Daniels and empty beer cans, just kicking away the detritus on my way to the bathroom, turned on that harsh bathroom light, and I looked in the mirror, and I honestly thought there was a stranger in the bathroom. I was like, who is this guy looking at me? And I realised it was me, and I saw the massive beer belly. I saw the yellow, chipped, nicotine-stained teeth, the bloodshot eyes, the wrinkles. And I just had this epiphany. I was like, who is this person? And then all of a sudden, it all came flooding to me, these questions around who had I always wanted to be when I was a child. I had all these hopes, all these dreams. I wanted to become this person. And I looked at myself and I thought, I am so far away from that person. And that was the moment when I decided to change. I always say, if you want something you've never had before, you must do the things you've never done before. Mm. And I wanted the health, the happiness, the confidence, the self-belief, the meaning in my life. And I thought, if I want all these things I've never had before, then I need to do what I've never done before. And I was thinking, what's the one thing I haven't done before? And then a voice said to me, stop drinking. And that's what I thought, right. That's what it has to be. And I hadn't mentioned even, my dad had died 6 months earlier, and he died very suddenly. And I watched him die. It was one of those moments when I was obviously hungover at work. I was kind of doing the hungover office thing. And you always see that work, like the head's in the chin, and you're kind of like trying to type with one hand like that. Just thinking 5 o'clock, almost there. Another few hours. And the phone rang, and they said, look, your dad's in hospital. So I had to leave work with nothing but my suit and my laptop bag.
What was it?
With my dad.
With your dad, yeah.
So he had some kind of bowel condition, which I think he'd been keeping secret from us. Whether it was bowel cancer, we don't know. He wasn't getting any treatment.
So he knew he was unwell.
Knew he was unwell, but he hadn't told anyone.
Right.
And I think he had a serious problem with his intestines. And the doctors basically said, look, he's too unhealthy. He was a heavy drinker, heavy smoker, lived a very fast life on his fourth wife by the time he died. And they said, look, he's too unhealthy to operate. So I jumped in the car, drove 300 miles. The doctor said, well, nothing we can do. Time to say goodbye. And he didn't know that morning that day was to be his last. And none of us did. And I certainly didn't know that was going to be his last day. And that was almost, it planted the seeds for everything I do now, for what I call the new me. Because I think he didn't know he was going to die that morning. There would have been a moment that afternoon when the doctors would have told him and he would have thought, oh, shit. And then I still to this day wonder what regrets went through his mind. What were the things that he always wants to do? What were the things when he was saying, oh, I'm going to do that one day, but I haven't got the time, haven't got the money, haven't got the confidence, all these things. And that's why it planted the seeds for everything I do now. It isn't about crazy challenges. It isn't about extreme adventures. It's about time.
Mm.
And it's about living that life, that epic life, where we have a life without regret. And then fast-forwarding it back 6 months following to me in that looking in that bathroom, I just thought, I am living this life of regret. If I died now, and let's face it, I was trying my best to make that happen, if I died now, I would regret so many things. And that's why I knew I had to kill that old version of me and start to rise like a phoenix from the ashtray to become the new version of myself.
Can you remember the last conversation with your dad? Was he coherent in hospital or was he?
No, he was unconscious in hospital. So the last conversation I had with him would have been a couple of weeks earlier. We had a strange relationship. It wasn't the kind of like father-son watching the rugby at the weekend kind of thing. Yeah. We'd speak, we got on well, but we wouldn't see each other for 6 months. We would speak every couple of months on the phone. And then I'd visit him and we'd get through about 4 or 5 bottles of wine. Then we'd be able to have a proper conversation. And then I'd see him again a few months later. But I knew he loved me and I knew that he wanted the best for me. He just couldn't really show it himself. But that's what I thought. I truly believe now, I believe everything that happens in our life, it's either a lesson or a blessing, or it's both. And I truly believe now that when he died, I had that choice. I was either going to take myself down a road that was going to follow him very quickly, or I had to make his death mean for something. I had to be able to create something good out of it. And I thought about my own kids, and I thought, what dad do I want them to have? The dad who's the life and soul of the party, who's going to be getting more hungover, who's going to be getting heavier, who's going to be just making these excuses that he can't play with them, all these things that we know. Or could I turn into this almost superhuman dad that my kids actually thought was cool? Still haven't achieved that. I wouldn't think they think I'm cool yet.
And the older they get, how old are they by the way?
They are 11 and 9 now.
Yeah, no, they're approaching that phase where you're going to be the biggest dick on the planet.
Yeah, basically. but I was like, it's all about being who I want to be. And I always, one of my mantras is, it is never too late to become the person who you were always meant to be.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought. I was to say, after it was 35, 36, part of me was thinking, is it too late? Just accept it. Just let yourself go. Every guy does. Like, guys in our 30s, going to 40s, like, it's fine. Like, beers at the weekend, do the job, have the kids. Like, that's the way it's supposed to go. That's what society wanted me to do. That's what my friends wanted me to do, because that made them feel better. So to take a different path was so painful and so difficult and so scary. But I thought, I still have to give it one shot just to see what I'm truly capable of.
Mm. Awesome. So that was like 5 years ago. It's been coming up 5 years
sobriety.
Yeah, it's come
to 5 years.
Yeah. Hey, just while we were on your dad, fun fact about him. So he worked for or with Steve Jobs in the 80s.
Yeah, definitely. So my dad was a creative genius. His side of the family was always slightly dodgy. So his dad, my paternal grandfather, my family came from Birmingham. He was in horses. So he sold horses to a group of gentlemen who are today known as the Peaky Blinders. So that's the kind of circles that my family moved in. My dad in the 80s, again, very good with computers, very creative. He invented, as he says, the first ability to record sound on computers. So he had this massive, like, BBC computer on the kitchen table, and he would try and speak into a microphone, and then the computer would play the recording back to him. And that was like a eureka moment back in the 80s. Mm. That led him from a number of connections to go out to the US. Next thing I knew, we were moving to America because Dad was working with Steve. And
amazing.
Yeah, and it was just like Steve, and I think I met him once, and I was eight years old at the time. So I didn't know it was like Steve as in Steve Jobs. I just thought, there's a guy called Steve.
We're skivvies every day.
Yeah, exactly. And with my dad being my dad, again, he was creative genius, very kind of that way of thinking, terrible at business, terrible at relationships. So we found ourselves back in the UK 18 months later, no money, no house, and obviously no jobs. And I always wondered, did that lay the foundations for me in terms of growing up? And everyone says, like, I'm going to be an astronaut. I'm going to be a sports star. I'm going to be an athlete. I'm going to be a massive business owner. All I wanted was stability. Mm. That's why I had a chaotic household with my dad's drinking, my parents' relationships, all this, you know, going backwards and forwards to America. One month we'd have money. Next month we'd have the debt collectors knocking on the door. And I'd be answering the door while my parents hid behind the sofa. And all I wanted was stability. And again, I said to myself, I just want a job where I get well paid, where I get a paycheck every month, and I can just live what I saw as a normal life. And it's funny, again, going back to who we are and our true nature, I told myself I wanted that when I had it, because I didn't really truly want it, because that wasn't truly who I was. I was doing everything in my power to subconsciously sabotage it and destroy it.
Mm. Yeah, I've got a similar journey, eh? Similar sort of story. You know, it's like the more assets and things I accumulated, the more I realised they were the things that I thought were going to make me happy, and they just weren't.
It's so funny. And I was listening to a recent podcast. They were saying that we all make the mistake of we accumulate the money and the things because we think that will lead to the lifestyle. But the real trick is to live that lifestyle that we truly want, and then work out how to monetize it, or then work out how to at least create enough money in our life to live that fulfilled life.
Yeah.
I look back now, I'm not going to lie, again, there were moments, there are still moments, especially when I make the mistake of looking on LinkedIn, which is the worst thing you can do. Because I see all my old colleagues in the corporate world, you know, so-and-so's managing director at Goldman Sachs, and so-and-so is like partner at HSBC and all these things. I kind of think, do I miss that? And like, they must be the money and the lifestyle, but then I know I wouldn't really be happy. And I think you must only be willing to swap lives with someone if you're willing to 100% swap the life. So just saying, oh, I'd quite like their pay packet isn't enough. Would you like the lifestyle, the hours, where they're living, who they're living with? And that's when I kind of undo a lot of my jealousy, because I said, I'd like some of it, but would I really life swap? And finally, it's been a journey, but being happy with where I am and what I've got, I can't give that up for anything.
Yeah. Well, so why the decision to move to New Zealand?
In a way, it was a long story. In a way, it was a quick decision. We've always wanted a family adventure. And again, this is very much what I talk about and what I stand for. It isn't all about ultra marathons and crazy runs. It is living that life without regret. And I know that someone may want to try an adventure in a different country, or a new job, or a new business, or whatever change they want to make in their life. And we were, it was the UK, it was during COVID. Without getting too political, there's like Brexit and everything else. Mm-hmm. And we, again, we were living in Liverpool in the UK. I'd had the Porsche that I'd been had so attached to then being stolen, and all these things. And all these, it's funny how these signs come into your life saying, like, maybe it's time to change something. Mm-hmm. My wife is a doctor. So she's a children's doctor. I'm not a medic, but whatever specialism she has, they needed here in New Zealand. And then the job offer came up for a year. And that means we were allowed into the country during COVID. We did the MIQ thing, which was two weeks
in a hotel with held with the kids.
They would have been a couple of years younger, so like 9 and 6 then.
Oh, my God.
But here's the thing, we had never been to New Zealand before. Yeah. And so living in the Bay of Plenty, which is a beautiful part of New Zealand.
It really is.
I had to look it up on a map. And it's crazy looking back now. So middle of COVID, never been to New Zealand, no friends, no contacts, no network, no nothing, just jumping on a plane. We landed and they said, you're going to a place called Rotorua for your MIQ. And I was like, where is that? Is that North Island, South Island? No idea. And it was literally taking that step into the unknown. And that's why I say when we talk about stepping out of your comfort zone, doesn't have to mean a crazy ultra marathon or a marathon. Mm-hmm. It could be going to live in a different country or a different hobby or a different career or whatever it is. And I knew that if I stayed in my comfort zone in the UK, I was always going to regret it. Mm. And it's funny that the people that we told when we said, you know, we're going to New Zealand, and everyone says, oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to, but I can't because of the job, because I've got the elderly parent, because of the kids are in school. There's always a reason. There's always a reason why we can't change. Mm. And I said, yes, there's always a reason not to go. But that doesn't mean that we can't. There's never going to be a perfect time. We have to make it the perfect time to change. And that's why I strongly thought at that moment, I could have said, okay, we'll wait until COVID blows over. Wait till the kids are a bit older. Wait till my business is a bit more settled. There would always be a reason to stay. But I thought, no, we have to go now. We have to make it happen. And we did. And I haven't been back to the UK yet. I never say forever, but for now, yeah, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. It has been difficult. It has been a challenge. It does feel a long way away from home sometimes. But the thought of staying in a life where I wasn't happy, where I'm always wondering what if, that feels like the biggest pain on earth to me.
Mm. Yeah, but you can't give New Zealand too much credit for your happiness because it's that's an internal thing, right? Oh. So if you're unhappy and you don't change the fundamentals and you move to a different country, you're still going to be miserable. You've had to do the work, and you gotta own that.
I think I do have to own it, really. Yeah, and 100%. It's difficult, especially being British. We're kind of like self-deprecating. And someone said to me once, going, I suppose, with a running metaphor, they're like, Freddie, are you running to something or are you running from something?
Both, I reckon.
Yeah, probably both. And it's funny. It's always a paradox because you could say, well, if happiness is an inside job, then I should be able to create my own happiness wherever I live, as you say. But then also I think, well, if I'm in a situation that's making me unhappy, either geographically, in a relationship, in a job, then surely it's my responsibility, again, to take ownership and leave that situation. And that's something I've always wrestled with the, you know, people of my wife said to me, why can't you just be happy? And friends who didn't want me to leave the UK, why can't you be happy where you are? I always find that's quite a get-out clause. We say to ourselves, yeah, could be worse. Suppose I should be thankful. Suppose I should be grateful. And this is where I had to give myself some harsh truths. And this is where many people say to us, oh, you're so selfish. You're so narcissistic. It's all about you, isn't it? Like, you know what? Fuck, yeah, it is about me. Because ultimately, I know I will be like my dad was, and there will be a day that's my last. And I think so many people, they give themselves the get out clause. They say, oh, I'd love to do that, but the kids, oh, I'd love to do that, but I'd be letting someone down. Again, so many times we fill our days doing things that we don't want to do because of guilt and obligation. We fill our calendars with other people's goals and dreams, and then we get regretful and resentful because we haven't followed our own path. Mm. And that's why, that's a lot of reasons why I drank. I know why people may turn to alcohol, to drugs, to sugar, to Netflix, to porn, to whatever their vice of choice is. It is because of a deep-seated unhappiness that they are not living the life that they want to live. Mm. And I think that's why, for me, it wasn't about, you know, once I was on the path to live the life I wanted, then I knew if I want to be on this path, then I can't drink anymore. That makes it a lot easier than saying, alcohol's bad, I can't drink, I shouldn't drink, I'm a bad person. I think that's again, an interesting paradox about change, because everywhere on social media, everyone always says, change. We need to change our life, change our mindset, change our habits. All the gurus like to talk about change. But I do believe that if we are going through our days saying, I need to change, we're almost implying to ourselves that we're broken, that we're not good as we are, that we need to be fixed. Imagine going through every day saying, I'm not good enough. I need to be fixed. So I think sometimes maybe we don't need to change. Maybe we need to actually embrace who we are and the path that we're on. And once we do that, then we can adjust the aspects of our habits, our mindset, our knowledge to achieve what we want to achieve.
Yeah. I like doing the best I can and just trying to get a little bit better each day.
Definitely.
So I suppose that's changing in a way, but it's just, being a bit kind to yourself as well. That's kindness. Something I've struggled with.
But, yeah, and I think we all do that. And I think the kindness is a crazy part, and it sounds a bit soft and fluffy.
It does.
Self-love, kindness, but I think a lot of it is through acceptance. And a lot of what I did in my past life is because I was extremely harsh on myself. Again, I was running from something. I was, even after exercise, that wasn't good enough. That wasn't fast enough. You should be out there. You should be up at 5 a.m. Any sentence that starts with "you should" or "I should be doing this," that's when I know I'm not being kind to myself. And I always knew that when I was, when I was reaching for a vice, and like I say, anything around chocolate, alcohol, porn, screens, Netflix, sugar, anything, it's usually because we're either stressed, bored, or lonely. Mm-hmm. We would rather reach for our vice of choice than accepting we're stressed, bored, or lonely. And it's only when we start to say, well, maybe it's okay if I'm stressed, bored, or lonely, if I accept who I am. We always think we need to accumulate new things to be worth more. We always think, I need to be worth more. I need to have the material things. I need to have the personal bests. I need to have the cars, the shiny objects, because I am worth more. Because deep down, I believe that I am worth less. I am worthless. Once you start to fix the aspect of, maybe I'm not as worthless as I thought I was, that's when the vices go away. Yeah. That's when we start to actually live the life we want rather than chasing the things that we don't really want to impress people who we don't really like.
God, I'm very guilty of that.
Yeah, me too.
but it's frustrating because I'm well aware that happiness needs to be here and now, because if it's something you're chasing, you're never gonna find it. But you can see it in slogans on Instagram or whatever, but implementing it into your own life's another challenge, isn't it?
Oh, I know. I call them slogan dispensers on Instagram, and you're totally right. Happiness is, they call it illusory. Confidence is the same. That the more you chase it, the faster it moves away from you, like a cat, really. The more you chase it, the further it moves away. So I was chasing happiness, I was chasing confidence, and it was moving further and further away. But I always slay, with the slogan dispensers. And this almost goes back to when I tried to fix myself, because I would read the books, I'd listen to the podcasts. And my company, they would get the dreaded motivational speakers in, and I'd be there on the front row with the notebook. I'd be like, oh, this is it. I was always searching for that missing piece of the puzzle. I always thought, this is the course, this will be the speech, this will be the podcast that gives me that missing piece, and then I'm going to change my life. But what I really found is that I couldn't relate to these people. And that's why I go on my journey to prove to people what a stressed, depressed, unfit, overweight mid-manager at a corporate can do. Because I'd be sitting on the front row. It is difficult to listen to the billionaire Tony Robbins telling you not to worry about money and relate to it. It is difficult to have the Navy SEAL Jocko or David Goggins saying to me, conquer your mind. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, but I've got the kids and the mortgage and the work deadline. Okay, Mr. SAS, Mr. Navy SEAL. I'm not that. I'm just this overweight guy who's not enjoying his job right now. It is difficult to have some privileged adventurer telling me how climbing Everest will solve all of my problems, but I can't climb the stairs without getting out of breath. So I couldn't relate to any of these gurus, any of these slogan dispensers who were telling me to change my life. And that's why I thought, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to step into who I really am, if I'm going to find this life of meaning, then I need to totally throw out the rule book, throw out the self-help guides, and try and create my own way of doing it.
Do you see the irony that you are sort of that person now. You're a motivational speaker and you're doing crazy shit. Like, we'll get into this in a second, the Ice Ultra. So there's going to be people sitting in the audience now that are like you 10 years ago, like, oh, this guy.
It's crazy. I do see the irony, definitely. And what I say to myself and what I say to people, and they say, oh, you know, it's okay for you. You've run the Sahara Desert. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not an athlete. Like, I come from this background where, you know, I was the slowest kid in my class. I was not athletic. I still have asthma. I used to go for a run with a cigarette to increase my lung capacity. That's the kind of athlete that I was. I don't have this athletic background. My background, as I say, was a 2-hour train ride to sit at a desk for 10 hours to do a job I hated, mm-hmm. and then have a 2-hour train ride home. And then I would then go for a drink. So I had the courage to walk through the front door, deal with the kids for an hour, and then drink myself to sleep on the sofa. That was my background. Not an athlete, not a Navy SEAL, not some privileged adventurer who grew up climbing Mount Everest. I'm an everyday guy who just chose to do extraordinary things. And that's why I believe that anyone, for me, it's the Arctic or the Sahara Desert or anything else. But it is the same process whether someone wants to go to the gym for the first time, run a 5K, start a business, end a relationship, move to a different country, start a new hobby. All of it involves developing the right knowledge, the right mindset, the right habits to step out of your comfort zone and step into who you really are.
Yeah.
And those lessons can be applied to anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about chasing good dopamine, isn't it?
Exactly.
And again, and whatever that is that makes you happy.
Exactly. And again, it's about embracing who you are. So I accepted that this is who I am. The problem turns up is if you accept that you are an all or nothing type, a sociable, life and soul of the party. It's when you start saying, that is a bad person to be. I can't be that person. I need to be someone else now. It's when you start saying, no, this is who I am. Maybe I'm going to start loving who I am and just focus my energy to more constructive aspects than destructive aspects.
Yeah.
That's the key part.
So we're recording this in early February 2024. You're like 2 weeks away from doing the Ice Ultra. What's the Ice Ultra?
The Ice Ultra is it's pretty much the world's toughest, coldest foot race. So I'm flying from New Zealand, 12,000 miles to North Sweden, traveling up into the Arctic Circle. And then it's a 250 to 300 kilometer ultra marathon over 5 days towards the North Pole. So it's temperatures of -50. No idea what that is in Fahrenheit, but very, very fucking cold. And carrying all my own food and survival equipment on my back, running the equivalent of anywhere between 50 and 65 kilometers a day, and trying to survive in these conditions, not just survive, but actually prevail, move forward and complete this race. And obviously training for it here in the New Zealand summer has not been ideal, but it's all about proving. And as I say, to me, what's important is proving that we can do the things that we thought we couldn't do.
Yeah.
And as I say, there's so many slogan dispensers out there. You know, we've all heard the phrases, step out of your comfort zone, the power of mindset, be more confident. And I thought at the start of my journey, why not prove to people? Why not just actually prove what we are capable of achieving? And that's why I'm on this very, very cold, very frosty mission. I say -50 degrees, running across frozen lakes, over windswept mountaintops, trying to avoid polar bears and wolves, and just seeing what this broken down ex-alcoholic corporate worker can achieve to prove to people that they can achieve their goals as well.
I've got so many questions about this race. So where do you sleep?
So you sleep in very basic tents. I think they are the traditional nomadic people that I think were called Eskimos in a different time, whatever the traditional name is for them now. They have tents made out of like wolf skin, I think. So they pitch a couple of those up, basically.
All the competitors stay in there.
Yeah. There's about 30 people in the race. All the competitors stay in them together. It's a kind of thing you try and light a fire. We have to keep the fire going all night to keep warm. So it isn't that race where you run around for a bit, go to the hotel for a hot shower and a hot chocolate and a nice bed. It is living, surviving, sleeping, out in the coldest place on earth.
So you're sleeping in the gear that you run in, pretty much?
Yeah, so I think the way it's going to work is I'm going to be running in gear, you make a fire, taking the gear off to try and get it dry because it's going to be soaking wet with the ice and the snow and the sweat. Get some thermals on. So I'm going to carry one spare pair of clothes, like the dry kit, get that on, sleep in that, then get up the next morning. Hopefully the running kit is dry, and then get that on again.
And freeze-dried meals?
Freeze-dried meals all the way. So I know there's some great Kiwi freeze-dried meal providers. And
Radix Nutrition, baby.
Well, I hear they're the best. So to keep me fueled on the journey. So yeah, I'm taking a party pack of those, getting the hot water in there. It's crazy, actually. We're told we have to take a minimum of 2,000 calories a day, which doesn't sound very much to me. So I'm going to be taking a lot more than that. We should be burning about 10,000 calories a day. And I'm not good when I'm hungry. So I'll be taking a few extra meals and then just trying to keep going. But it's a thinking race. That's the challenge. And thinking for me is not easy at the best of times. But in this race, you think about the food, think about your nutrition. But your water freezes, your gels freeze, your chocolate freezes, everything freezes within 90 seconds. Mm. So I say with other races that we do, you think, yeah, I'll have a gel, I'll have a chocolate bar, whatever it is. If you take peanut butter, it freezes. See, it's always about thinking what has the lowest thawing point? How do I? I had some interesting ideas of where I could store food to keep it warm. That probably isn't very hygienic, to be honest. So it's about trying to again.
At least no one will try and steal your snacks.
Yeah, exactly. It might not taste very nice, but no one would try and steal it.
This tastes like ass.
Yeah. And so saying where could it be around that? So it's all about thinking about nutrition, race strategy, all in this environment where if you stop for 90 seconds, you start to freeze. Hypothermia comes in, frostbite comes in. And that's why I say I think the biggest challenge on this race, physically it's going to be tough, but mentally to keep going and also to actually think about what I'm going to have, when I'm going to have it, all the strategy around that, it's going to be a minefield. Mm.
And what do you wear on your feet?
So it's going to be snowshoes, right. Which again, I've been trying to get used to. So I've got trail running shoes, three pairs of socks, and then the snowshoes to strap on when needed. And again, trying to run in snowshoes. Sometimes when you're running across the frozen lakes, it's just on ice, which you hope is quite thick. I've been running on thin ice for many years in my life, so hopefully not on this occasion now. And then sometimes the snow could be a metre deep. That's when the snowshoes come out. I knew people that have run the race and a snowshoe broke. The strap on the snowshoe broke. They had to take their gloves off, try and fix it. They got frostbite and they're out of the race. And that's what I think scares me the most. It's that something out of our, a bit like life, something out of our control can happen that can totally derail us. And I can talk about ownership and all these things that sound very, you know, very deep thinking and macho and all this stuff. Yeah, take ownership and extreme ownership. But you always think in life when something tiny happens that's out of your control, that totally derails everything, how do you react? And that's why it's one of my rules for life around how you react in times of chaos. And that's what I'm truly interested in, because we could all perform when times are good, when life is good, when the sun is shining, when you're going for a nice run along the beach and you've had your 8 hours sleep and you've got your mindset podcast on and you're nicely fueled and you've had your water and everything's fun and cool. I know you can perform on those days, but what about the days when you've had no sleep because you're worried about money and the kids are sick and your boss has shouted at you, you've had an argument and your mental health feels like it's falling apart and the strap on your shoe breaks and the traffic lights are red and all this shit happens in your life. Can you still perform on those days? Now, that's what I'm interested in. How can you perform when it feels like everything in your life is turning to chaos? I think that's when we can truly understand who we are and we can really understand what our potential is. I always believe that your performance will rise to the level of your problems. we only truly find out who we are. We only truly find out how we are capable of performing when we overcome bigger and bigger challenges. And that's, I may have a few of those to put myself through in the future. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, well, it's going to be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's because you must find this as well. I'm a little bit older than you, but as you get older, you realize, you know, the days turn into weeks, the weeks turn into months, months turn into years, and unless you schedule memorable things like this, the years just roll into one, don't they?
It's true, and I've been looking at this this concept. Have you heard about the misogi concept?
No, what is that?
Misogi is a Japanese word, which means I've definitely pronounced it wrong. but it's derived from a Japanese process. It's called water cleansing. So apparently the tradition in Japan is once a year they go and stand under a cold waterfall, and it's like this soul cleansing. So it's kind of like pressing control alt delete on your mind. And now how it's evolved is to everyone to have a misogi, which is a year-defining moment. So it's doing something that defines your year. So you can look back. Right. So for me, like, this is my misogi. I can look back and say 2024, my misogi was running across the Arctic. Again, for someone else, maybe it's the year they started a podcast. Maybe it's the year they started a business. Maybe it's the year they did a 10K. But it's thinking to yourself, what is the one thing that's going to define my year? And it has to be something that scares you, that you're not sure that you can complete. Because otherwise, as you say, we kind of drift through life. Like someone said to me today, oh, you know, where did January go? And as we get older, time does go quicker. Mm-hmm. So it is about, I encourage everyone. And part of this is part of my mission to help people lead an epic life. I say, unless we can take control of our lives, again, our calendars get full of other people's goals and dreams. We put our bosses, our colleagues, our kids, our family. I'm not saying we have to be totally selfish, but unless we take ownership and say, this is going to be the year that I do X, and we put it in our calendar, then it's not going to happen. So I encourage everyone, and my coaching clients, to say, let's create that misogi for you. You have your one big year challenge and then a number of micro adventures. I always talk about having a micro adventure every 2 months, which may be a concert, it may be a weekend hike. It doesn't have to be expensive. But again, diarizing these things, and because that's how we actually create a year. If you create enough days that are powerful, then you have the powerful weeks and you have powerful months. That's when you look back and say, holy shit, 2024, what a year. Because otherwise we just look back and you think, 2022,
what happened
there? Yeah. I think, oh, something COVID, obviously. And then you look back, 2015, what happened there? And unless it was a birth, a marriage, death or a divorce, we tend to not remember the years. And that's why I kind of get angry. And I get angry because I think, how dare we live these lives where we perform less than what we're capable of doing? Mm. Everyone is capable of doing amazing things. And it doesn't have to be a physical challenge. Again, it could be the business, could be the book of poetry, it could be pottery, it could be whatever. But I get so pissed off when people hold themselves back from their potential. And, oh, I haven't got the time. That's a big one. I haven't got the confidence, haven't got the money. If only. Well, I think let's make it happen, because no one deserves to live that life that I lived, that life of quiet desperation. Mm. I think everyone deserves more than that.
Yeah. How's your mental health now? Pretty good, up and down?
Wow. Up and down, I think, is the honest answer. I still freak out on a regular basis, I'd like to say. I can control it better. Even yesterday, I think now this race is coming so close, I kind of joke about it. I'm like, oh, shit, I guess I've got to do it.
And then made that joke when we were wandering up the stairs.
And then I was like, yeah, but I do have to do it. And this is where self-doubt for me is big. Imposter syndrome is really big, and I've learned this concept around what's called the part X, and we all have this part X within ourselves. It's basically our own worst enemy. It's our own worst enemy who is designed to screw up our life. It's Newton's third law. Every force has an equal and opposing force acting upon it. So however much we want to push ourselves forward, we have an equal and opposing force within ourselves trying to pull us back. And that's what I call my part X. That is the part of us that says, you can't do that. You're too old. You're not good enough. That's the part of us, the way you look in the mirror, that says, oh, getting a bit old, aren't you? You're too old to start that business. You're too old to find love. You're too old to start the new career. You're too old to walk into a gym. And I have that massively. Again, I say, looking around at my happy friends with their normal lives and the great careers. I'm like, oh, Freddie, what have you done? So yeah, I still struggle with my mental health a lot. And I always try and find a quick win. You know, whether it's a green light, whether it's your toast falling butter side up, whether it's something, you know, a kind word from a child, whether it's great gratitude. But it's always thinking that there's a quick win. Because failure, especially mental health failures, are not final. Mm. Unless your failure is your last failure, that's not really a failure. I strongly believe that our best opportunities are always ahead of us. So this is where I say, even if I'm having a bad day, a bad week, a bad start to the year, the best opportunities are always ahead of me. And that's what we always have to remember, I believe. The best days are always in the future.
I love that. I know I said at the outset that we're going to do like a podcast of two halves, the fruity story and then some takeaways for others. But I feel like it's been sort of peppered through the whole chat. It's been really inspiring, mate.
Well, thank you. It's really cool. And it's funny, like I never went out to be an inspirational person. And I went out to try and create the best version of myself. I think so much of what we try and achieve in life does come down to ourselves. Yeah, people in the business world, for example, they say, why don't people trust me more? It's because you don't trust yourself. Mm. Why doesn't my team have more confidence in me? It's because you do not have confidence in yourself. Why don't people listen to me? It's because you don't listen to yourself. Why don't people love me? Well, then that's maybe because you do not love yourself. Mm. And I truly believe that the journey that we all have to go on, it has to start with ourselves. And we always say, how's 2024 going to turn out? I can see the future. I can perfectly predict the future. 2024 will be exactly the same as 2023 unless you're willing to change something. Yeah. And that's what I found. And again, with me, and I know I talk about change, and do we actually want to change, or is that a good thing or a bad thing? But it is that willingness to try something new, to surprise ourselves, to embrace ourselves, rather than, as I say, being a photocopy of a photocopy of someone else. If we are willing to embrace who we truly want to be, who we truly are, then that's when we start to be on our own true path. And that's why I say it's never too late to become the person who you are always meant to be.
Mm. Are you proud of yourself? You love yourself now?
Yes.
I asked this question because I think there's a lot of parallels with English and New Zealand. You know, sort of call it stoicism, call it what you want, but it's a tricky question for us to answer without seeming, like, I don't know, braggy, I guess.
I know, and it's that British stiff upper lip. Am I proud of myself? I kind of cringingly say yes. I'm never satisfied, and there's the song from The Greatest Showman, again, showing my macho, so I'm not an SAS Navy SEAL guy. I'm like, this is me in The Greatest Show, but it's that song of Never Enough that I long. It's I can't remember the full word. Yeah, all the stars that you steal from the night sky, all the gifts that move by will never be enough. And for me, that's the case. And no one understands this, not my wife, not my friends, not my family. They say, why don't you just stop? You've got the medals, you've got the world records, you've done the races. The Arctic, is that going to be the last thing? And then are you going to stop? And I kind of think I'm not.
No. Absolutely not.
And I'm like, and it's weird. I don't say this in this kind of like alpha, no, don't quit way. I almost say it with a tinge of sadness because part of me would love to stop. I would love, if I'm totally honest, you get the real truth out of me on this podcast. I never usually say this. It's like a therapy session. I think if I'm truly honest, I would love to be that person who could just be happy, and that's why maybe I miss the old me. Mm. The old me who could just be happy, just watching the sport on the couch with a few beers, just getting quietly sloshed on a Sunday night. I kind of miss that guy sometimes. But I know, again, in my true nature, there always has to be something more. Maybe, and I don't know if I say maybe, but I know, I think if I stopped, then that dark shadow of depression would come back in. Mm. Then the alcohol would be more appealing. And that's why I know, for me, I can't stop. But say for someone else, whether their thing is writing poetry or baking or being a great parent or knitting or jogging, whatever it is, I think if you find something that lights up your soul, that doesn't hurt anyone else, that makes you think, this is what I love to do, this is who I am, then why should you ever stop? Why should you ever quit? Surely you shouldn't want to quit who you truly are.
Oh, I love that. You mentioned a world record before. What's the world record?
So, yeah, the world record was a funny one. I'd like to just sprinkle that in there. The world record came about after I ran across the Sahara Desert. I did the marathon de Sable, the world's toughest foot race. And
yeah, in the Sahara. It's an incredible run.
Yeah, it was a crazy run. And again, when I signed up for that, that was the start of the journey. So I couldn't run a kilometre when I signed up for that race. Did that, did the crazy run, came back. And this is a funny tie-in because I thought that was going to be it for me. I'd done the race. It was a journey, as they say. I'd had the transformation. It was kind of like the hero's journey had come to an end. I'd done the media, I'd written the book, I'd grown the social media account, and I kind of thought, oh, hang on, I've got a story now that I could dine out on for the rest of my life, and I could tell the tales from the Sahara Desert. And then the depression started to creep back in. Yeah, the pizza menu looked more appealing. The beer looked more appealing. And I could feel the old me coming back in. And again, that dark shadow of depression. And then one day I was talking to my kids and I was doing the whole like kind of, son, are you proud of me? Are you proud of your dad? Run across the Sahara Desert, don't you know? Yeah. And they were like, oh, God, Dad, I'm so bored of that. I'm so bored of you talking about the desert. I was like, what? What? Don't you think I'm a great... And they were like, no, Dad, I'm so bored. And then they got the Guinness Book of Records for Christmas and they said, Daddy, we want you to break a world record. I was like, oh, okay. And I thought, well, I'd obviously done a bit of running by that stage. So I thought, let's look at the running world records. And they're all really bloody fast. Like world's fastest postman, world's fastest cheerleader, world's fastest postbox. Like they're all like sub 3 hour marathons, running marathons dressed as these crazy characters.
Yeah, it's crazy. Even the world's fastest marathon with a stroller with a baby. Yeah. It's like a sub 3 hour marathon.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I was good at running, but I wasn't that good at running. Yeah. And then so I thought, well, yeah, can't do that, can't do that. And then there was this thing around the world's fastest fisherman. At this stage,
what does that even mean?
It means the fastest marathon dressed as a fisherman.
Oh.
And at the time, we lived in Liverpool, which is it's a big maritime city. It's by the docks, you know, by the ocean. My kids were at that age where they loved fishing and they loved sharks. They loved the sea. And they were like, and we saw this, 4 hours, 45 minutes was the record. And I was like, I could do that. I could, you know, by then my marathon time was about, I think 4 hours 15 was my PB. Mm. So I was like, I could do this. Yeah, 4:45, I could make. So I wrote off, you know, you have to write off, you have to apply
register.
To break a record. Yeah. And I kind of forgot about it. And, you know, the kids were like, Daddy, break a world record. Daddy, break a world record. I was like, shut up. Okay. Just to keep you quiet, I'll do the world record. And then I wrote off, forgot about it. And then a few weeks later, the email came back and they were like, challenge accepted. You know, your world record attempt is on. I was like, what was this again? And I always thought that it was, you know, fly fishing, like, you know, carry a fishing rod, have the waistcoat and the hat with the feathers in. And I was like, oh, this is quite pleasant. And then they send you the 3 pages of rules that you have to follow. And they meant like deadliest catch fisherman. So heavy waterproof jacket, heavy sou'wester hat, heavy waterproof trousers, carrying a 3 kilo fishing box that had to weigh 3 kilos and wearing gum boots, wearing, you know, we call them welly boots in the UK, the rubber gum boot Wellington boots, having to run a marathon in those. And that's what I thought, shit, this is actually going to be tough. And there's a good metaphor for life here, because I was then fast forward, I was standing at the start line of the Liverpool Marathon, 20,000 lycra-clad runners there. Then there was me standing there looking like a cross between a serial killer and the world's shittest male stripper. There in this big yellow waterproof outfit with my waterproof fishing box and my gum boots, about to run this marathon. It's a funny thing having 20,000 people pointing at you, laughing at you, shouting at you that you're going to fail. And I still had to take that first step, and then another step, and then another step. I think it's a metaphor for life that sometimes we have to be prepared to look stupid to go after what we want. And we have to be prepared to have people laugh at us, laugh at our goals, shout at us, tell us we're going to fail, and yet we have to move forward anyway. And I took a step and another step, and it was horrific. My toenails fell off about halfway around. I was like, what's this rattling in my boot? I was like, oh, okay. And then just like the sweat was all pooling, and there's nowhere for the sweat to evaporate. It was all pooling. So if you've ever walked in like those welly boots, those gum boots that are full of water, it's like squish, 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 trying to run, and the clock was ticking. And I came around the corner, the final straight, and I thought, this is going to be close. And I thought, oh no, I went into that tunnel vision. You get the roaring in your ears and your vision goes to black and white. I thought, oh shit, I'm going to pass out here. I'm going to pass out spectacularly inside the finish line. I thought, I'm going to miss the world record by a couple of minutes. And that's when I thought, this is, I'd rather spectacularly fail than just miss it by a couple of minutes. I thought that's what's going to happen. But again, I'm going to have to carry on anyway, even though I think I'm going to fail. And then just as I was about to pass out, I kind of stopped and I halted and I felt this little thing in my hand. I looked down and it was my son's hand in mine, and he jumped over the barrier and he'd grabbed onto my hand and he said, Daddy, come on. You can't stop now. And then my other son jumped over and they dragged me over the finish line pretty much. And so the pictures in the paper, you all see like me kind of about to pass out and my son's running ahead of me and just crossed the finish line and collapsed and yeah, broke the record. It was 4:37. I got it in. So broke it by a few minutes, but it was crazy. Yeah. So I can now say I am, and I've kept that record now for about 4 years. So 8 billion people on the planet. I am the world's fastest fisherman, and I still carry the scars on my heels from it. It totally took the backs off my heels. It was a horrible ending. Kind of, there was like a family having a nice British picnic at the finish line, a bit like here in Auckland. You had the finish line at the park, family having a nice picnic, and I kind of collapsed next to them, lying on my back, feet in the air, and my kids are trying to pull the welly boot off me, trying to pull the gum boot off me, and they're like, heave, heave, and they're like, it's not coming, Daddy, it's not moving. And I yell, heave, and they pull it, and this gum boot flies away, and then this mixture of blood, sweat, skin, toenail just goes, whoosh, flies into this family's picnic. and I was like, but I'm a world record holder. They weren't impressed. Yeah, we kind of ruined their day, but that's what happens. But yeah, it is about crazy challenges, and I laugh about it, and it's a bit of fun. I love to go into schools talking about how the kid who was the slowest kid in his class became the world's fastest fisherman. But I truly believe that we have to be prepared to get laughed at. People say my goals are crazy. I would say someone else's goals are crazy. Who cares? As long as it matters to you, as long as it lights up your soul, as long as you don't get to that day that my dad got to, where you look back and think about a life of regret. And that's what I care about. Who cares if they laugh? It's Elon Musk that says, first they laugh, but then they applaud. And that is that life of saying, be prepared to look stupid. Be prepared to be laughed at. But nothing is worse than living a life of regret. People laughing at us is short term, but that success, that achievement, those stories live with us forever.
Yeah, that's cool. What a yarn. I agree with that so much. I had this crippling fear of failure, I think, for maybe the first 40 years of my life. Now I'm really leaning into it, because it's like, yeah, what's the worst that's going to happen? Someone's going to laugh at you.
Yeah.
Well, they're a fucking idiot.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's someone whose opinion doesn't really even matter to you. Why would you take that on board or stop it from living your best life?
It's crazy. I see this so much. I still suffer from it a little bit. Like, with some of the social media stuff that I do, in the back of my head, I still think my old boss there in the UK, we're there saying, oh, what's Freddie up to? You know, when's he going to grow up and get a proper job? And these sorts of things. I think it's such a crime that we don't do what we want to do. We don't live the life we want to live. especially on social media. So many people are scared to step out of that shadow they've created for themselves because they fear judgment. They fear people laughing at us. And I think, well, let them laugh. And I kind of believe, I don't think this is 100% true, but the phrase goes that anyone who is doing better than you, anyone who is higher up the ladder of success than you, will never laugh at you.
100%.
It's always people that are below you that will laugh at you. And I do know some people who kind of, like to belittle others, but I think they, the opinions of other people do not matter. At the end of the day, it is our life that matters. I did an exercise a few years ago called An Introduction from God. And that's probably mean with a small g, so we don't open that religious can of worms, but call it writing your own eulogy if you prefer. How would you like people to talk about you? How would you like to be introduced through the gates of heaven? And that's when I started to think, I actually wrote it out, you know, write out your own eulogy. It's a really powerful exercise. And then technically, every decision that you make after that, you should be saying, is this decision moving me closer to that life that I want to live, to that person who I want to be, or is it moving me further away? I try and take a hell yes or hell no approach to life. And that saying is, if I have a decision to make, if I'm not saying hell yes to this, then it has to be a no. And that is such an easy thing to say and such a hard thing to do. If I'm not saying hell yes to this decision, then I'm saying no. Because we all say, oh, I don't really want to do it, but I said I promised I would, but I'd be letting someone else down, but people would laugh at me, but people might not like me anymore, so I'm going to have to go and do it anyway. But you've only got so many days, you've only got so many decisions to make in your life, so why not start making them for you rather than for someone else?
Yeah, time is such a precious resource, isn't it? It's so infinite.
Definitely.
Are you familiar with the phrase tall poppy syndrome? Is that a big thing?
I am. It's not a thing. It's a thing, but it's not a phrase in the UK, but I've heard it a lot being here, definitely.
That's a massive thing. It's like what you were talking about before, where you said anyone that's doing better than you or is more successful than you is never going to laugh at you or mock you. It's a tall poppy thing. In the States, I think they call it like crabs in a bucket as well. It's like a crab tries to climb out of the bucket and the other crabs will try and drag him back down again.
Definitely.
But it's dumb, and you can't let it hold you back from living your life.
No, I totally agree. And I think if I'm totally honest with myself, did I start to use tall poppy syndrome as an excuse? Because I talk about the victim and the owner mindset, like we said at the start. I believe that it isn't like a binary thing where you say, I used to be a victim and now I'm an owner. We can approach any day from a stance of a victim or an owner. I could be a victim this morning when I'm blaming the traffic and say, oh, the traffic means I'm late. Really, if I'm an owner, I said, no, I should have actually left home half an hour earlier and I wouldn't have this problem. It's not a traffic's fault. It's my fault. But when we look at things through the eyes of a victim, I could blame tall poppy syndrome. I could blame my old colleagues. I could blame my family members who say people in our family aren't athletic. People in our family aren't good at marriages. People in our family aren't good at business. I can make all those accusations of blame, or I could actually take ownership and say, yes, you know what? Fuck yeah, I am a tall poppy and I'm going to own this. And if other people want to hold me down, then they can do that. I was listening to the concept of ego. It's a Ryan Holiday, ego is the enemy. But is it really? I think our ego is actually designed to keep us safe. Our ego is designed to push us. And yes, as a Brit living in New Zealand with like that tall poppy double whammy, that's an incredibly difficult thing to say. But I believe that when we are at our lowest moments, when the relationship's ended, when we've been fired from the job, when we've failed in the race, when the business has gone under, I think we actually need an ego, because it is our ego that has to get us out of bed the next day and say, no, you're going to pick yourself up and you're going to try again. You're going to go again. Failure is not fatal. Failure does not have to be final. It is just another step on the journey. But to embrace that step, to dust ourselves off, to go again, that's when we have to dig deep into our ego and say, you know what? I am going to be a tall poppy. I am going to own this. Life kicked my ass yesterday, but I can win today. And we say, unless our failure is our final failure, then it's never truly a failure.
Yeah. There's a saying that's popular in New Zealand, especially at schools. where kids get called tryhards. So no one wants to ever like try too hard because you don't want to stand out. And I look back now from the perspective of a 51-year-old man, it's the most ludicrous and insane thing ever.
I know. And it's crazy. I think back to my school and it's funny. I lived my life in my rebellious phase was an adult. I was a very well-behaved teenager. Again, my life was such chaos at home. I sought sanctuary in school and I didn't have approval from my parents, so I tried to get approval from my teachers. So we had these what they call merit marks at my school. So you get 50 merit marks in a year and you get a certificate. And I was like, I need this. Yeah, this achievement to maybe feel something inside myself so I could feel like I'm worth something. And so I would volunteer to pick up litter, to pick up rubbish in lunchtime in my school. That's why I didn't have a girlfriend until I was 19. Because the other kids were playing sport. I was this like slightly chubby kid going around picking up litter so I could get this merit mark. And when all the cool kids, like the tough bullying kids, came up to me, as kids tend to do, they were like, oh, you try hard. What are you trying to do? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, you know, I got put in detention for fighting. So teachers, yeah, they're making me do this. But really, I was trying to be like a good boy. And I was like, if I pick up enough, it's a metaphor for life. If I pick up enough shit, then maybe someone will love me. Mm. But yeah, there is that try hard thing. I didn't want to be seen as trying hard. It's difficult, isn't it? You think when... I believe when we're truly stepping into who we are, things should be difficult. But also when you're in your zone, when you're in your flow, I don't believe that we should be feeling like we should be trying hard. It should be feeling like it's natural, because that's what we are doing, what we were born to do.
Yeah, I like that. Hey, there's been so many takeaways. I'm inspired. I'm sure a lot of other people are as well. Best of luck with the Ice Ultra.
Thank you.
And what's your Instagram handle? Is there going to be updates on your Instagram?
Yeah, there'll be updates on Instagram. It's the Freddie Bennett. That's where you can find me. It's Instagram, Facebook. The website is Freddie M. Bennett. But generally, yeah, you can find me wherever. Just search for the Freddie Bennett. And look, I always say, it isn't me doing this race. We're all doing this race. I'm just the guy doing the cold bit that involves the running. But anyone who's on a mission, anyone who has a dream, anyone who wants to step into that person who they know they can be, we're all doing this together. And I do this, as I say, to prove to anyone that they can create the life they want to create. With the right habits, the right mindset, the right knowledge, anyone can live that life that they know they deserve.
Awesome. Freddie Bennett, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
On the Dom Harvey podcast, thank you so much for making it all the way through. What did you think? I thrive on your feedback. I love it. Good or bad, constructive criticism is the only way we can improve and get better. So you can get a hold of me anytime you want, domharveynz@gmail.com, or if you're on Instagram, domharveynz. I genuinely mean that. I'm not just fishing for compliments. Compliments, as lovely as what they are, they don't get you anywhere. If you have any feedback, constructive criticism, ideas you've heard on other podcasts, I would love to hear from you, so please reach out. Hey, one other favour. If you don't do so already, on whatever app you listen to this podcast on, presumably Spotify or Apple, could you rate the show if you haven't done so already? 5 stars would be ideal, but just your honest opinion, that would be good. And if your podcast app allows, I don't think Spotify does, but I know Apple does, leave a review. All that stuff helps to grow the podcast. Oh, one more thing. If you have a YouTube account, follow the show. You can you don't just have to listen to the podcast. It can be a visual experience as well. You can watch the entire episodes at the Dom Harvey NZ YouTube channel. Also, one last thing. Now that I'm doing 2 episodes a week, I'm looking for some more cool brands to work with. If you think your business could benefit from podcast advertising, please get in touch. domharveynz@gmail.com. domharveynz@gmail.com. If you've listened to more than a few of these episodes, you'll know how much I care and respect about the brands that I work with and the brands that choose to work with me. And that could very well be your business. So if you like the content and you want to grow your business, or you just actually genuinely want to help the podcast, please reach out. It would be wonderful to hear from you. Hey, but ultimately, you don't have to do any of that stuff. I just appreciate you being here and appreciate you taking in the content.
All right, that'll do us for this week. Thank you very much. And I do hope to see you next time on the Dom Harvey podcast. See ya.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.